Picture this, two guys trapped in the South Charleston Public Library. One guy loves movies, the other, well, he'd rather be watching reality TV. Can they survive each other's favorite films? Find out on Real Opposites, a library podcast about movies, hosted by Josh and Aaron from the South Charleston Public Library.
Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of Real Opposites. I'm Aaron.
I'm Josh. And we're going to talk about a couple of movies we picked for each other last week. I picked Dark City for Aaron.
And I picked Across the Universe for Josh.
So I think first we're going to roll with Dark City.
Okay.
But spoiler alert, there's a pretty big, substantial kind of twist in the movie, and we're going to be talking about that. So if you haven't seen the movie, you may want to seek it out. We have it at the library. Before you listen to this, unless you're just really cool with being spoiled.
Yeah, true. So, I watched the movie, and I think sometimes where I don't like to watch movies, I will watch a movie when I'm not in the mood for it. And I think this movie fell victim to that in the sense that it felt really long and like really slow. But I did like the overall story of the movie. And I think thinking back on it, since I've watched it, I think about certain parts and I'm like, oh, that was really good. And so I think I liked it.
I think you'd like it more if you watched it again at some point.
Right. Yeah. If I ever, you know, felt like it, I would probably like it the second time around even more. I didn't not like it. But I liked the concept. I liked the story a lot. It was kind of down my alley as far as, it was almost like Stephen King-esque. With some of the just weird turns and like the weird outcomes of things. Just the way the plot is. I don't know. Okay. But it was something I liked. To me, okay. It just reminded me of some of his kind of stuff.
I can see that maybe like in something like the Dark Tower stuff he does.
Yeah.
Like,
so I thought that was pretty cool. I think that the movie was really well done as far as, what was it, 98?
It was 98.
98. I mean, it still kind of looks really good.
Oh, yeah, because they use, I mean, most of the stuff is miniatures.
Oh, okay.
Like, there's some digital things, like when they're kind of collapsing buildings,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of what you're seeing is a miniature, and they're just moving things back and forth on a miniature set.
Oh, that's cool.
And, like, that huge, expansive view of the base station thing, I guess, it's all a big miniature.
Oh, okay.
It was made in 98, so digital effects were very... They were getting better, but they were still kind of crude to a point, unless you had a ton of money, which this wasn't like a huge budget movie.
Mm-hmm.
And just back then, it was just easier to do this kind of stuff with miniatures.
Oh, okay.
Because like every night they change...
The city.
They change the city and the architecture and the buildings, and that was just easier to accomplish.
Okay.
And I think I think it looks better than if you had done it digitally.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like that, the changing of the city and everything is what still looked pretty smooth, really good. Most of the movie, I think, just held up as far as visually.
Yeah. The photography is beautiful.
Yeah, it was really good. I did notice that, which normally I don't notice, and maybe that's partially because we've been doing this and I know to look a little more. But it was something that I did notice about the movie is that it just... the presentation of it and the visual aspect was really good. But there was so much of the story that I thought was cool, like just the fact that they're experimenting on people to try and figure out like what makes humans human.
Yeah.
Plus you had the good versus evil, like if somebody murders one day and then the next day they have a different memory because their memories change.
Yeah.
Then do they still have the gene in them too? Like, is it a gene factor that makes them a murderer? Is it their way of living and the memories of their past?
Yeah, it's kind of like the aliens are kind of figuring out, I forget what they call them, I know they call them something.
Strangers.
It's like they're running a computer simulation almost.
Right.
Try to figure out like nature versus nurture.
Right.
What makes someone decide to become a clerk at a hotel or a police officer. I think that's pretty fascinating when you think about it. I love that they don't explain too much about the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
You know that I think there's I think Kiefer Sutherland, there's a line where he says that they took the corpses out of graves. So they abducted dead bodies from Earth.
Yeah, they never really explain that
So they reanimated everyone. Or if like the strangers themselves are
corpses.
Are just corpses they took and they, you know, because they live inside the brain.
Right.
Of the humanoid.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I like. I like that there's not, it's more ambiguous mm-hmm. about the world and like how, where everything. I love that kind of stuff where it just doesn't tell you everything straight out of the box, which the theatrical version does. So you watched the director's cut.
Yes, I did.
So for anyone listening, do not watch the theatrical cut. There is an opening narration by Kiefer Sutherland's character that pretty much just spoils the entire plot of the movie right up front. I guess the studio thought that people were too stupid to figure it out. So they put that in. So the director's cut fixes that and a couple other little things.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something I liked about it was you didn't exactly know what was going on, but it was a movie that, at least for me, I found it easy to figure out what was going on. I forget what movie it was that we've watched before that I didn't like because I didn't know what was going on.
Mad Max,
yeah. That one, like, because I couldn't figure out, it just was too much. But this one, I mean...
Maybe it was like the Mad Max was like overstimulated.
Yeah, maybe.
It was just like, it was too much. Because really the whole plot of that movie is they turn left.
Right. I guess that's true. I think I was maybe overthinking it, which would make so much sense.
Yeah.
But this one, you had all these different themes in it. And it was, I like that. Because they were kind of addressing different themes with different people. Because then you even have the cop who's like, I'm a cop and I need to find you and you're the bad guy and blah 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 blah.
It's like someone dropping into a role.
Right.
Like
exactly.
In a role playing game.
Right.
Or simulation.
Yeah, exactly. But as it goes on and he's talking to John Murdoch, John keeps asking him, like, you know, when was the last time you saw daylight? How do you get to Shell Beach? And, you know, it's things that nobody knows, and it makes even the cop guy start questioning everything.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat where it goes into that as well. What they believe and just by their memories and what role they've been dropped in.
Yeah.
And the expansion of their mind as well, stepping out of the box from that. And,
yeah.
And seeing, oh, like, this world isn't what I thought it was.
And it's like, one of the things I do like is that the movie just drops you into John Murdoch's. You're just following him for pretty much the first third of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Until, you know, the Jennifer Connelly, Emma, she comes in, and Bumstead becomes a bigger part of the movie. Mm-hmm. And what I like is that they really could have started, I mean, they kind of had to start with John Murdoch because he's the one that has his tuning interrupted. And that's really what gives him his ability to kind of see and tune like the strangers.
Right.
But I would have, like, you could have easily made another movie too where you just follow Bumstead, like the detective, and he slowly realizes what's happening, and there's a lot of possibilities with that concept.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they could have went from any angle.
Yeah.
And the story could have still developed, but it would have just been a different angle of that story, and I think that would have been neat as well. I will say, like I said before, I did kind of figure out what was going on. I think...
What gave it away? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm trying to remember what gave the first part away, but at the first thing I thought is, okay, this is like the Truman Show.
Okay.
Something about it just made me think of that. I don't know if it was like the first time somebody was they went to sleep,
or
where they put them to sleep to change the city.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was that. I can't remember exactly.
There's a part early on when I think Murdoch takes out one of the strangers and you see the alien head.
Okay, so that was the second part.
Yeah.
So I already thought it was the Truman Show.
Okay.
And then when the alien came out, I was like, okay, so there's like these aliens, they're running this city to figure out Earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, I figured it was up on whatever planet or wherever they were from. So I already kind of figured it out. But even in that sense, I liked it because I liked that I kind of knew what was happening.
Yeah. Made it fun to kind of follow along.
Yeah. That it made it better for me, at least.
That's funny you bring up the Truman Show because there's a lot of these kind of late 90s, very similar themes like Truman Show, Dark City, The Matrix, even Fight Club to a certain extent, where they're all about how you're a cog in the machine.
Right.
How, you know, the society puts you in one box and you just need to stay there, and you know, how there's kind of like a Big Brother-ish 1984 control going on.
Right.
It's kind of funny how all that happened at the end of the millennium.
Right.
There's a lot of movies and art that were very similar.
Pretty based like around that.
Yeah.
Which I like the Truman Show.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, and I found that interesting. Just the fact that this world and on the Truman Show, his world, both were just created to basically study
humans.
And it was a neat concept where on this one, on Dark City, it was aliens and trying to figure out what makes humans human. But yeah, so I kind of figured it out way ahead of the twist, I guess. Because I kept I kept watching and I was like, okay, where's this twist? Because you had told me there's a big twist, you need to watch the director's cut. And I was like, all right, where's the twist? Where's the twist? And then, like, I got done with the movie and I was thinking, well, I never saw a twist.
I guess you kind of figure it out at that point that it's like, there's definitely, like, it looks like a noir. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you have the noir lighting, the hardened detective.
Which I loved, by the way.
Yeah. You have the hardened detective, the guy accused, the kind of fugitive, and you have the femme fatale kind of character.
Right.
And then it just kind of, you're like, oh, wait, this is sci-fi. Like, when the alien pops out of the head or whatever. But I guess, like, the twist, I was like, is like when you finally realize that it's just, like, this city floating in space, that it's not, like, on Earth or something else. It's, I guess, more of, like, a aesthetic twist.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also depends. Had I not already thought, oh, this is, like, the Truman Show.
Yeah.
Then maybe, like, the alien popping out of the head wouldn't have been such a clue. It would have been like, oh, okay, now it's sci-fi.
Yeah.
So I think it's just the way I thought about it made it not much of a twist, because I already assumed they were in space, because I assumed,
okay,
if nothing else, they were on whatever planet.
A different
aliens.
Planet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, it still was a cool, like, the when they bust it open and you see that it's like that wall is literally just then it's space.
The long pole.
Yeah, it's still a really cool scene, regardless.
And I love that they, like, just in that shot they showed, like, the underworld, and later on in the movie you get to go. John, they take John down there into the underworld where the machinations of the city and how they control it. It's like one of those things in a movie that I never forget that visual. I just love that moment.
I also like that shot where it's the pull out when John, once he's down in the undercity, he's changing the city, or maybe he's not in the undercity anymore. But anyways, when he changes the city, and they do that pull away, and you can kind of see it's just like a floating city.
Oh, yeah.
And then it starts, like, flooding to create the beach.
Oh, yeah,
so you have just the water on the edges, but you see, like, the whole city and it just floating in space. I thought that was really cool, too. And it kind of, like, hammers it in even more. Like, this is all fake. Just by John being like, thinking he needs Shell Beach there. Here comes the water, and it was a really cool visual, but also I think it really hammered in, like, the storyline too.
Yeah, what was fake is now real. It gives you, like, an emotional finale for John and for Emma, but there's a lot of possibilities. Like, what are they doing with this floating city now?
Yeah, what happens after
that? Yeah, it's just like, I'm glad they never. I mean, the movie didn't make a lot of money. It didn't do very well.
Oh.
It came out in the wake of Titanic, so nothing made
makes
any
sense.
Money.
Right.
but I'm glad they didn't do, like, a sequel or, like, a comic or anything like that. They just, you know, sometimes it's the best to just leave it to your imagination what happens next.
Right. And I think, in a way, they wrapped it up, though, at the same time, to where they didn't need a sequel. Because in the middle of the movie, Emma starts to realize John is right. Like, this is fake, and maybe they were never even married. That's all made up. You know, the cheating, all of that, that was part of their storyline. That probably never happened. But at the end, he gets Shell Beach. He's walking out onto the pier, and she's there. And he asks her how to get to Shell Beach. She knows how to get to Shell Beach, and they even show it. And then she says, you know, I'm going that way if you want to come with me. And that's kind of the end. And it's, okay, he got Shell Beach.
Yeah.
He's got this city that he can control. They can make their real connection and go from there. And it kind of is, there's a lot of possibility of where it could go, but at the same time, it's kind of wrapped up.
It is.
So I think that was a really good ending
And
as
I like that they made, like, the destination a beach, because at the end, you know, where they're not having their memories tampered with, you know, water signifies, like, rebirth and being born. So they're both on the beach.
Oh, that's true.
And, you know, maybe they'll have a relationship, maybe they're not, but now the possibilities are kind of endless and
right.
they're reborn as whoever they want to be.
Right.
Not the role the strangers are picking for them.
Right. And that's what I say with it being kind of wrapped up. And I like that. I like when a movie doesn't leave it too open, but then there is still where you can just fantasize about what might have happened next. Or in your head, create the next part. But at the same time, you don't have to. Like, here's the ending of the movie.
Yeah, the story is finished.
Right. And you don't have to wonder. There doesn't have to be a horrible sequel or anything like that.
Also, another Jennifer Connelly standing on a pier movie, A Requiem for Dreams, really good too.
Okay. I've not seen it.
Almost like same shot of her standing at the end of a pier.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Made a couple years apart, but...
I have a fun fact for us about the movie. So the doctor, Dr. Schreiber, is actually named for a German judge called Daniel Paul Schreiber, who wrote a book called The Memoirs of My Nervous Illness, in which he suffered a few mental collapses over the course of his life. And in his madness, he wrote that the world was revealed to him as an enormous architecture of nerves dominated by a predatory god. Who, like, essentially his book comes down to he believed that there was a outside force that moved the world around in ways to control.
And then they made a movie out of it.
That's
and
cool.
that was in 1884. And, like, his work contributed to a lot of the basis of Freudian psychology and stuff like that. So,
that
really
cool.
neat. There's then that, 100 years later, informed this movie.
There's a lot of little things like that in the movie. Roger Ebert does two commentaries. He does one for the theatrical cut and then one for the director's cut. They're two separate commentaries. And if you're at all interested in visual literacy and like how to watch a movie, those two are excellent. He provides a ton of information like that it's fascinating. It's one of the best commentaries you can listen to.
I think
he even mentions the Schreiber thing too in there.
I think that's something I need to do more is watch... like commentaries, because I do find like when we come in here and we record and we talk about these movies and I just have like a normal I don't watch movies kind of opinion, but then you give me all this extra stuff, it always enhances the movie a little bit. Like that fact of, you know, there was a book and this character is based on it, like it makes it have so much depth that you don't get when you just watch, or at least I don't get when I watch a movie.
Yeah,
I'm just like, oh, cool scene, but you know, there's so much work that goes into them that just without doing research or watching something like that, you don't get. So I think that kind of stuff is really neat, and maybe I need to watch more stuff like that. I think I would find it interesting.
There's some commentaries that are really good, like the Roger Ebert. He did one on Citizen Kane, too. And there's some good ones that are... If you get someone like kind of more academic, and the movie's maybe a little older, there's like some... They usually can be very informative.
So hopefully, I should hope that Ebert did it for Crossroads.
I wouldn't count on it.
There's probably not even commentary on that.
No, I think they just dropped that one on a bare bones DVD. You get a theatrical trailer.
Nice. All right, so I guess that kind of wraps up Dark City for the most part.
Yeah.
I had you watch Across the Universe.
You did?
Yes. And...
And so I'll tell you what. So recently, Olivia and Toby mentioned what big fans they are of the 2004 Phantom of the Opera with Joel Schumacher. Joel Schumacher directed with Gerard Butler and Emmy Rosen.
Mm-hmm.
I adored that movie.
Okay.
It was fantastic.
I did not watch it.
Just wonderfully theatrical and vivid. Songs were great. Like, the cast was... I just loved it. It was like... That's an ideal musical for me.
Yeah.
Across the Universe is not. It's the example of what I don't like about musicals.
Oh, okay.
The musical numbers get in the way of the story. They don't tell the story. Because I got to about a certain point. It's like, I'm enjoying just the movie without the musical numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I just don't want to watch the musical numbers. I just want to watch the movie. Like, I just want to follow the story or the characters. Because,
right.
I mean, it's like, it's nothing groundbreaking, but I think it's pretty well done. Everyone's showed up, brought their A game. And it's not to say the musical numbers don't look great. Like, visually, Julie Taymor does a great job. I'm a big fan of her Titus Shakespeare adaptation with Anthony Hopkins. But, yeah, it's like, it's just an example of what I don't like about musicals, where they don't, I don't feel like they use the music. The music is a distraction.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of
funny. Except for the Joe Cocker one. I kind of like that.
Right? Isn't that good?
The Joe Cocker one was good.
That's one of my favorite parts.
Everything else, no.
Well, it's kind of funny because I think it's the complete opposite. Like, you don't have tons of dialogue. I mean, there's dialogue, but you're right in the fact that there's a lot of music.
Yeah.
But I think the songs are used in such a sense that they tell the story. I don't know. I feel like, because obviously it was all Beatles music.
Yeah.
I feel like the way they chose the songs, it carried the story even further. Because you got a little bit of dialogue about what was going on, but then the song in the lyrics would put more to the story.
Like, the songs are like a reflection of what the characters are feeling. And like, right. You'd kind of go 15, 20 minutes and then be like, okay, now we're going to have a musical number where Jim Sturgess is, you know, this is what he's feeling, or this is what Evan Rachel Wood's feeling. But I feel like I already knew what they were feeling, because it's like they shot two separate movies.
I see what you're saying.
It's like they could have just shot a movie without the musical numbers and it would have worked fine. It's like a 90-minute movie.
Right.
And I just kept getting distracted by the musical numbers. And like I said, the musical numbers are fine. Like, they're well... It's the exact opposite of Hairspray, where this is like the inverse of Hairspray. I thought the musical numbers in Hairspray, like, the songs are fine, but I felt like, from a filmmaking standpoint and visually, they were just kind of a little...
lackluster.
Just a little, you know, basic.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I thought, you know, visually, they're almost like music videos. Like, you have a 4 or 5 minute break from the story, and you have music videos, and like, I thought the Joe Cocker one was really good, and the Eddie Izzard one, where he's like the circus ringleader, I guess.
That one is pretty good.
That one, you know, like, they work fine on their own. I just don't feel like it all gelled together.
It wasn't necessarily needed.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't regret watching it. Like, I was so tired of seeing the trailer because it seemed like it was in front of every single movie I saw in like 2007.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, I'm so done with this movie.
Yeah.
Just stop showing this trailer in front of every movie. I just see Jim Sturgess.
It was really pushed back then.
Yeah, it was. And that was probably part of my hesitancy to watch this movie for 15 years. I was like, oh, that trailer, sad memories. So that's my, you know, I think it works. I think if you just cut the musical numbers, it would work fine.
Yeah.
Because it has a kind of like almost, it doesn't span as long of a timeline, but like Forrest Gump is very similar. Like,
that's
true. It deals a lot in the 60s and 70s. That's where mostly Forrest Gump takes place. And I feel like something like that is more what I think this would have worked better as, where like you have music, but it's a little bit more integrated into the story that
instead of like break off.
Yeah, that takes place over years. Whereas instead, you're across the universe, you're just kind of breaking off for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
into a music video.
Do you feel like it's the problem of there were too many songs? Because I think there are some songs that are great that definitely like progress the story, like "I Want You" and "She's So Heavy" with Max.
Yeah,
when he goes like. There are some things you couldn't really lose and still get the story, but there are a lot
of musical numbers.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to say. I think that could be part of the problem, too, because you're not a huge fan of musicals.
Yeah.
Whereas I love musicals, so...
What?
There are 31 musical 31. Numbers
wow.
in Across
that's,
the
that's excessive. That's a lot. That's excessive, even for
that
like 100... Like, the movie's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, I think.
Yeah, it is.
That's,
which is a long movie, by the way.
Yeah, for, I mean...
for me.
Yeah, I mean, for this one was too long.
I watched it in two parts.
31?
Jesus.
Yeah, but I guess... So I will also say, and this is probably not a lot of people's opinion, or maybe, I don't know, but as far as the Beatles, I'm not exactly a Beatles fan.
And
that has nothing to do with me liking this movie. Like, when it came out, I probably couldn't even name a Beatles song, to be honest. But once I watched the movie... I liked the songs. I thought they fit. I like the way they progress the story for me. And I liked the people singing them.
Yeah.
So I even went and I tried to like listen to the Beatles versions of the songs. Yeah. And well, I like the movie versions
a lot better. That's what you heard first, probably. So yeah. It's like that's what you
well, and
that's
it just like. And sometimes the Beatles kind of just sound the same because they are the same people.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously. Whereas these were different people singing different things.
Yeah.
But I think as far as like the musical numbers meaning anything, I think like the what I consider the climax of the movie when Sadie is singing Helter Skelter there towards the end and they have all those protests going on. Lucy's at the protest and
they're up on the roof. Is that what you're talking about?
No, not
okay.
This is just a scene when she is with that
the dude
like the leader and the cops are rushing the building that protest when they get arrested.
Okay.
So you get that and then also you're getting a view of what's going on at the war as well.
Yeah.
And so you see Lucy's getting arrested and Jude is getting like knocked down by the police.
Yeah.
And then Max is at war and there's like shooting going on all around him and he gets injured. And I don't know, there was something about that. Plus Sadie is singing this song after she broke from her band, which was like a big deal.
Yeah.
And is failing out on her own.
Is that the number where the soldiers are carrying the Statue of Liberty?
No.
Okay. That's when he first goes to war. This is towards the end.
Okay.
This one mainly consists of those.
There's scenes. So many musical numbers. They get
31. This is the scene when, like, they show the arrests and things like that, and they show Max and Moore, and then Sadie is just kind of on the screen, and it's like black behind her, and it like they duplicate her, and she's like swinging her hair around and singing.
Yeah,
and
I remember that. Okay.
I don't know. There's something about that scene that I think is just perfect for that movie because it kind of does, and then just Helter Skelter is good, and I love her voice singing it, but it just kind of brings everything to that climax of everybody is kind of realizing all their mistakes and all their, and they're kind of seeing the outcome of their choices, in a way. But I don't know. So I think there's some scenes kind of like that one that...
Yeah, I mean, it's the movie's not like a waste or anything.
Right.
Like, there's still a lot of positives in there.
Right.
You know, like there are some good numbers and there are some great visuals.
But I do also get your point in the fact that, I mean, I love it the way it is. I love all the numbers. I think it helps the story. But there are some, like the one you mentioned, where they're carrying the Statue of Liberty.
I think some of it is like...
Maybe we didn't
exactly. It's a little too...
I like it.
I think it's a little. Some of it's a little too on the nose, like on the nose, like a little bit. Like, all right, yeah. I mean, I get. It's very theatrical,
right?
Musical, so I'll allow it.
Yeah. But, so nice.
But it's also like, I think that's the like 31 numbers. It's like, it just gets to be
a lot
too much.
Yeah,
it's overdone. I think, and I think if you scaled some of the numbers back, just the amount of them, and you know, maybe just balanced it out a little bit more.
Yeah,
I feel like it would have been a better movie, but
I see, and that's the I don't know. Like, I say, okay, say you remove the one where they're carrying the Statue of Liberty. For me, I think it still takes away from the story because in that song is when they're like turning him into the soldier that everybody thought you had to be back then because he is totally not that.
Yeah.
And then, so during that song is when that transition is made.
Yeah.
And that kind of sets you up to see his travel through war through other songs up leading up to the one I was talking about at the end where like the shooting's going on all around him and he kind of is just staring at the camera and he realizes like, what all he's into.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I mean,
I see what your point is, but I still think it would change if you took anything out.
Musical's not known for their subtlety. So,
right.
Like, and like, and I remember that visual. I think that there's just a little too much of the of
the breakaway.
Of that. Of just kind of...
I mean, you could probably do Strawberry Fields and Blackbird and I Want to Hold Your Hand without wrecking the story besides setting up Prudence's character.
Yeah.
Like, There's several that I like.
I want to hold your hands. Pretty important to Prudence's character.
It is pretty important for Prudence's character.
I mean, that is the complete setup of Prudence's character. That is. You could probably have done the whole song.
That's early.
They could have done like a snippet.
That's really early, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the first ones.
Yeah, because that's how I felt. Like I was pretty with it for like the first hour or so. And then it just kind of...
And I guess that's
just
true.
It's just too much, too long, too many numbers.
But
at the same time, I'd rather have a movie try too hard.
Right.
Than... be lazy, and I'm not. Right. I can't say this movie's lazy.
Yeah, like, that's true.
It just doesn't work all the way for me.
Yeah.
So.
And maybe instead of removing them, it would be just shorter.
I'm gonna cut together like a 70-minute version of this.
There
movie
you go.
With no musical numbers.
Oh, with none. Okay. But the other thing, I mean. Going away from the music, which I absolutely love the music, but where you mentioned Forrest Gump, and another great movie, obviously. Yeah. It deals with so many types of things that were going on at that time, and I think Across the Universe does that as well. You know, you have the politics going on, and the group, the radical group she's with, and war and drugs was a big part of the movie, too, when they go with Bono. And they're on that bus. And it was a big part of that time, your different groups that you had.
I think that kind of points to maybe one of the problems with the movie is that it tries to do too much.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things Forrest Gump does so well is that it you see all these things, but you're seeing it through his eyes.
Right.
So it kind of clarifies
the
story.
I can see that. I mean, I think they do it well in this movie. Okay. But then again, I mean, that's why this is... We have different opinions.
Yeah, exactly. This is real opposite. It's not real similar.
That's true. But I kind of liked seeing all that, and it developed... Like, you had a character that was almost in every group that they were representing.
Yeah.
And then you have Sadie and JoJo, who, somewhere I read, kind of were supposed to resemble, like, Jimi Hendrix and...
Janis
Joplin.
Okay.
They weren't supposed to be them, but kind of give you the idea of those type of characters back then and their struggle in the music with the breakup of the band and her trying to go out on her own and she fails. And, at the end, she's back with the band and all of that. So I think I liked that part where it also was just everybody was going through something at that time and it reflected a lot of what everyone was going through at that time.
Yeah.
But... through different ways. So I think it's cool, and I think it... But I do see how, with Forrest Gump, you're seeing it through one person's eyes, and it's his view of everything.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of just seeing it on a straight line.
Yeah, and I think it... I mean, if you're going to do, like, a long... Like, take... If you're going to take, you know, like, the civil rights, the political assassinations, the Vietnam War, like, so much that went on in the 60s and mid to late 70s, you need a little bit more clarity.
Right.
And I think it's just kind of all over the place.
I think maybe I just like things that are all over the place. But because like...
Very like Jackson Pollock.
I don't know what that means. But yeah, just like that. but because with this, like the themes... Because you have those known themes, the 60s themes, but I think there's so many underlying themes as well.
Yeah.
Him going over there to find his dad, all about how there was a lot of soldiers that would have children over in the sea.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't know their
parents.
And then you have him, he meets Max, and they have that, which is a musical number. But during that musical number, like, they become such good friends, and there's that friendship that they build, and then they kind of become each other's family.
Yeah.
And... it's just, they go through that, and then, of course, there's, like, the love stuff with the, once again, love is thrown in there. But I don't think it's too heavy. I guess it's kind of heavy, but...
No, that's the part I enjoyed the most was...
Jude and Lucy.
The Jude and Lucy,
but,
like, their relationship.
Yeah.
Those were my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think if the movie had just focused more on them and maybe another character or something,
Well, I mean, you get... I mean, if
I think
you
when
like,
it deviates away to, like, Sadie's...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
It gets distracting, and it gets like off
course. See, I like it all over the place. But because that's what I was going to say, because if you do like love in movies, then you do have Jude and Lucy, you have Sadie and JoJo, and then you have like Prudence trying to figure herself out. So there's a lot of different types of things going on.
Yeah.
But once again, that's all over the place, and I guess that kind of describes me, so I like the movie a lot.
Yeah, what is it?
You do you, bro.
Prudence has like four romance arcs over the
something
course
like that.
Movie.
Yeah,
it's just
like,
it's exhausting.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
yeah. It's
she's very confused, I think. She's trying to figure things out, but and then
actually, one
of the funniest,
one of my favorite characters, but yeah,
yeah. It, oh, I love her, and but I think one of the funniest things is, that happens in the movie is when they go on the bus with I Am the Walrus.
Yeah.
And they get to the circus tent, and they're walking in, and they're like, is that Prudence? And Prudence is one of the performers in the circus, so she had, like, went away and became part of whatever was there.
Yeah.
And, it like, they run into her randomly throughout. She's just everywhere. And I kind of like that about her, because that was just her free-flowing spirit trying to figure out what she was doing with life.
Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, I love the movie.
I'm glad you like the movie. I'm glad it satisfies you.
Yeah. This was probably the first time I've watched it since back when it came out.
Yeah.
I've owned a copy of it since it came out, but I've probably never watched it. And I want to watch it again. Like, it kind of solidified the fact that, yes, I actually love this movie.
I'll watch the trailer again.
Yeah. Well, if you do make that little snippet cut, the 70-minute one, maybe I'll check that out and see what it looks like without music.
I might actually do it.
Yeah. I do agree with you in the fact that the storyline itself is enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make a movie out of it.
I think, for me, as a person who likes musicals, the music helps.
Yeah.
But without the music, I think it still would make a good movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So. The music is great.
Yeah.
And the musical numbers are great.
Well, and that's what I said in the fact of, like, with the music, when I tried to listen to the Beatles version, it was boring.
Right. Ew, Beatles.
Yeah. And just that the different voices, like Sadie's voice. I love Sadie's voice. So Sadie's voice singing any Beatles song, I'm probably going to like it better than the Beatles singing their song. Because yeah. I like that voice better. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I think that was mainly that. But there's so many of them, like, that I really liked. I don't even know who sings Let It Be when they do that scene. It's the riot. And
the
little
boy,
he's
yeah.
singing it, and then he dies during the riot, and then it's like his mom singing at the funeral.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that song.
That's a good one. That's a good,
yeah.
that's a good one.
One time I made a CD with songs for If I Ever Died, and I actually put that on there.
Like that version?
Yeah.
But that kind of, I mean, not to take away from, this is what Aaron wants to play at this funeral, to that, like, that kind of does signify, like, so there's this kid singing the song, but I'm like, why is this kid singing this song? Who's this kid?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, you know, where it just kind of goes everywhere.
I think it, yeah, I guess. But see, I think it was showing other things that were going on at the time with the marches and Martin Luther King, and that's what that was.
Yeah.
Because it was a raid, you know, that was going on. Yeah. And then it shows how brutal they could be with this little child dying.
But that's what I'm talking about, where I think, like, the movie gets distracted by the time period a little bit.
Okay.
Like, you know, as I say, if you just focused on the love story or focused on a couple of different interweaving stories,
right?
I think the movie would work better than trying to, like, encompass,
like, everything
that happened from, like, 1966 to 1975 or whatever. It's too much. Like, Ken Burns can't do
that
in, like, 20 hours. I don't know where you're going to be able to do this in, like, 2 hours and 20 minutes, Julie Taymor. It's a little much.
I actually do know who Ken Burns is.
Hey.
So.
All right, listeners. So next month, we're going to throw you a curveball. And instead of us picking movies for each other, we're going to bring in our fearless director, Todd Duncan. And we're all... Move closer to the mic, sir, if you're going to speak. And we're going to talk about one of Todd's favorite movies and the documentary about the movie, Troll 2.
And oh, my God!
That was just a little sneak peek of Troll 2. The most amazing movie ever.
And we'll be talking about the best worst movie ever.
Yes.
The documentary about the making, or about the movie, and its cult status.
Yeah. So, if you're interested in watching that ahead of time, definitely check out both of those. And I think we may also just discuss, it's kind of like a B-movie.
Is the B-movie.
B-movie is being generous. Yeah.
The documentary is called Best Worst Movie.
This is true.
So, I mean, that stands for something.
Right.
Yeah. It is deliriously awful in the best way possible.
So, we all have seen this movie. We actually all enjoy it. So, it's going to be different for this next podcast, but I would recommend watching it ahead of time. We're all going to watch it again. I think it's going to be fun, and Todd is going to be here with us. So.
And text the library feverishly if you want us to do a live commentary on the film.
Yes, we'd love to.
I thought about that.
I'll make cupcakes.
All right, guys. So next podcast, definitely going to be different. Look out for some... Maybe we'll even do something different with the next podcast other than just the theme of it. So
you're definitely going to say, "Oh my God!"
So be on the lookout for that. We have summer readings going to be starting in May. It covers May, June, and July. Then we're going to do Real Cinephiles again. It is going to be a little different. We're actually going to have it at the LaBelle, and that's going to be Monday, May 16th, and it's 6 p.m. and showing Raiders of the Lost Ark.
How many times have you seen Raiders of the Lost Ark?
None.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. Is that the one?
I think
I've seen like pieces of Indiana Jones.
You haven't seen it.
I've probably seen the trailer. Like I know the ball, the big boulder like rolls over him. So
that's gold.
There's that.
Keep talking.
This is every podcast.
Okay, so that I guess that wraps up our events that's coming up, and stop by and see us sometime.
So that does it for us, guys. I'm Josh.
I'm Aaron.
And we've been real opposites.